Monday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Loaded episode today. Got to talk about that Plumlee Nurkić trade. We'll start off with that. Then do the first half of our 15 and 60. Start off with Toronto and Detroit because I watched that game that had a lot of notes from it last night. And then go through about half the alphabet, save the second half for tomorrow along with news. Before we get started, though, I want to tell you about a new little endeavor, an extension of the Twitter NBA show. I'm calling it for right now, Twitter NBA show second screen, which is basically a live version of the Twitter NBA show. I started doing that just at home. I'm sure Danny will be incorporated at some point if he ever comes back from vacation, and it went pretty well. We had 100,000 viewers on the first one, so that was a pretty good success during Spurs Knicks. So I'm going to try it again tomorrow night for Minnesota and Cleveland on NBA TV. If you want to join me at Nate Duncan NBA on Periscope, if you want to get notified, you go into the Twitter mobile app. There's a little bell next to my name, and there's a drop down menu that says get an alert when this user goes live. So you can get an alert that way too if you don't want to follow me on Periscope. Our sponsors today, SeatGeek. Use that CapSpace code to get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. And Zeal, in-home massage, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. A Zeal massage therapist could be at your door in as little as an hour. And I really like them a lot too because they show you the breakdown of how much the therapists get, and it allows the actual therapist to get a lot more money than you would if you go to a bricks and mortar type place. And the tip is already included as well. They're very transparent on the breakdown of their fees and who gets what. So a cool company. That's zeal.com, promo code CapSpace to get $25 off of your first massage. So let's start talking about this Mason Plumlee trade. The particulars, Danny, were?
So the principals going to Portland in this deal were Jusuf Nurkić, the third-year center from Bosnia, and a first-round pick. It is the first-round pick for 2017 that Denver is owed by the Memphis Grizzlies, and it's top five protected, but that is almost definitely not going to matter. And in exchange, Denver received Mason Plumlee, fourth-year player from Duke, and in the last year of his rookie scale contract, so he'll be restricted at the end of this year, and a second-round pick in 2018, which I believe is the worst of the Kings and the Blazers picks.
Yeah, that first-rounder has been on quite an epic journey. You remember, it was the price for Memphis to dump Maurice Spates on Cleveland once upon a time. Then it was one of the two first-round picks transmitted in the Timofey Mozgov trade, and now finally will come to fruition, a pick that maybe not as sexy as it might have appeared for Memphis a couple of years ago. They have staved off decline pretty impressively so far this season. They're going to make the playoffs, of course. What were your initial thoughts as soon as you heard this one?
My biggest takeaway from this trade was, and still is, that apparently Portland had decided that Mason Plumlee was not their center of the future. Whether you think of this as a cost-saving move or not, they made that decision and they're going to roll with it from there.
A lot of different components to this. Number one, let's take it from the Denver side first. I think that they really value Plumlee. Their thinking in getting him was they have this way of playing now with the floor space running through Nikola Jokic in the high post, getting all these back cuts. Plumlee, another excellent passing center, can allow them to play in similar fashion. I don't think he's going to be quite as effective there because you don't have to actually guard him out there, so you can just kind of back off. And Denver doesn't have like these awesome shooters where you really have to get up as a big on a DHO to take away a three-pointer as he comes off the screen. But nonetheless, I think that all makes sense to me. Denver also was really getting hurt when Jokic was off the floor. Darrell Arthur, in and out of the lineup, has been effective at sometimes as a small ball center. They'd been awful with Nurkić on the floor. He basically had kind of checked out at this point and is known to have some attitude problems. Wasn't really helping the team now that he wasn't going to be starting. And they, of course, tried Jokic and Nurkić together, and that didn't work particularly well. So that's the thinking in terms of getting Plumlee. But there are some downsides to acquiring Plumlee as well. And the other thinking was that they could play Plumlee and Jokic together. That part I really don't get at all. I think that they are much better off just playing either a combo forward. Juancho Hernangómez needs more time, as he showed today, just lighting up the Warriors in a spectacular home win for the Nuggets. So, and then of course they have to re-sign Plumlee as well for probably major cash.
To say I hate the deal for the Nuggets is a little bit strong, but it's really close to that because it's such a strange identification of talent, because Plumlee is a good player who does not make sense with the concept. I mean, we have already seen the Nuggets try Jokic with a center who can't shoot. I mean, Plumlee is much more gifted offensively, but those gifts in conjunction will not work as well, in my opinion. And defensively, it just straight up will not work. Neither one of them can really, I don't feel comfortable with them defending fours. Also, neither one of them is particularly adept at switching. So I don't see that as working.
Yeah, neither of them can guard fours. Like, I mean, right. Their problem is defense, and Plumlee does not help that. I know his rim protection numbers were good. I know that, but he really lays back on the pick and roll, doesn't have the mobility. I don't think he's a good defensive rebounder. He may have a good defensive rebound rate, but going against the biggest centers, he's not really strong enough to box them out, can't really rise up over them. I don't think he's a quality defensive center. I think that he proved that in the playoffs last year. And then also his problems finishing at the rim, like all this playmaking that he does, and he takes too many long twos as well. Not as efficient as a player of his ilk could be. Usage is too high. I think he's a quality backup center. I always felt like the Blazers needed to upgrade as a starting center, and I think that they're correct about that in making that determination themselves, in addition to the potential luxury tax concerns.
Right. And I'm sure part of the benefit for the Nuggets in this trade was that it makes the Blazers worse, and they're competing for the eighth seed. And yeah. It just so happens tonight that the Nuggets won and the Blazers lost. So that makes that even clearer than it was before. But if Portland was willing to trade Plumlee, then they were probably going to trade him. Like, this is a good return. I would say this is a reasonable return for him, especially considering he's about to get properly paid, assuming restricted free agency.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, yeah, whether he gets properly played or not, who knows? But at age 27, he's going to want to maximize his earnings. I don't see a ton of landing spots for him to get a restricted free agent offer. I think that was probably part of the Nuggets calculus as well. But hard to imagine that he's on your roster next year for anything less than $12 million a year. And that's pretty expensive for a guy that I expect to be a pure backup center for them. I mean, Jokic does get into foul trouble, but ultimately you're going to want Jokic playing 30 minutes a game. And as we don't want to say established, but we both are very much of the opinion that they can't play together.
Also, if that is your mentality, that, you know, basically he's your backup and hopefully it works a little bit better together, the cost part of it is a big concern, and the age part of it is a big concern too. Like, you can give up assets to get your backup center.
That's another big problem for me. If he were just like, you know, if you could say, hey, he's going to just play at this exact same level for the next 4 or 5 years, and you're going to pay him $12 million a year, I liked it a lot better. But when Denver is ready to compete with this young core 3 years from now, he may not even be, you know, he could be like kind of a crappy backup by that point if he ages normally.
Like his brother. And he'll be paid like his brother too. It's perfect.
Yeah. Now, another reason in the Nuggets thinking here and is that they felt like they already have too many young guys who aren't playing. They're not going to use 2 first-round draft picks this year on actual players. Like, and Nurkic was essentially a sunk cost to them. Now, you can certainly make the argument that first rounder and Nurkic might have had a higher value than someone like Plumlee, or that they should have prioritized getting the defensive wing that we've talked about them needing so many times, if you're going to have, or a defensive four, if you're going to have Jokic as your long-term starter at center, not able to defend anybody. So that's a criticism of that. It could be that they beat the bushes to find a superior deal. They knew that Nurkic's value, if they didn't move him at the trade deadline, was only going to get lower. And maybe this is just the best that they could do. They also got paid $2.5 million. Which helps a little bit as well. I mean, if you think back, that used to be how much a first round pick cost a decade ago. Basically, it was like $3 million. You know, the Rudy Fernandez pick got sold for that much. I think the Rondo pick got sold for that much. So that is not insignificant for a franchise that doesn't do well on the business side. But yeah, I just think that it's really putting that much into Plumlee. He's just not that good now. And this was probably the best he's ever going to be.
Also, it really hurt. It doesn't devastate or kneecap the idea of the Nuggets coalescing their assets into something else, because Plumlee is basically about to turn into something that they can't move, because he's going to be properly paid unless he gets a really good value. And that first round pick could have been a part of a bigger deal. Mason Plumlee can't. So I agree that there's a very reasonable argument that they were going to have to move Nurkic, but they sold low on him not in the concept of value, but in the concept of what they got back.
It's too bad that they couldn't just make it work with Nurkic as the backup center. I mean, they still have Kenneth Faried too, who's kind of been playing as a backup center too. Where the heck does he fit in now that you got Plumlee? That's a question. But I just, when you consider the resources that they're going to have to put into Plumlee, which is Nurkic, a guy who had some value, still a first rounder, and now $12 million a season at minimum, could be 15, could be 16, you know, and especially because, I mean, if you're another team with space and you see the Nuggets as just, you know, a potential rival, you know, once they've made this trade that they have to match anything on Plumlee. So, you know, why not just throw a $15 million a year offer sheet just for shits and giggles, because they have to match it. It's the same thing as like the Enes Kanter trade for OKC, although at least Denver can replace him, so maybe it's not quite the same. But I just don't believe in putting those kind of resources, those picks, a prospect, and then that amount of money as well into someone like Plumlee. And I mean, if you really wanted him that bad, how about you just make him like a great offer in restricted free agency? I think part of this too is they may just be over prioritizing a little bit, making the playoffs at Portland's expense this year. I think that was maybe a larger part of the appeal than, you know, it probably should be when you consider that making the playoffs this year means that you're just going to get destroyed by the Warriors.
We've certainly seen that get prioritized before. I mean, Milwaukee did that a couple of years ago.
Yeah, the JJ Redick trade, which was, you know, they gave up Tobias Harris for 3 months of Redick. At least they have him as a restricted free agent. But still, I mean, between Plumlee not being that good, backup centers in general just being relatively available, them, Jokic and Plumlee not being able to play together. I mean, I think that's the biggest miscalculation. If those guys could play together, I would like this trade a little bit more. But, you know, they can't. And we'll get to later on just like trying to play two centers together, how well that worked for Toronto today. It's not going to be good. And I think also, that's the biggest part for me.
A point I wanted to make on this from Portland's end is, not only did they decide that Mason Plumlee is not their center of the future, if it's not Yusuf Nurkic, it's going to be very hard to address that, because this trade reduced their luxury tax bill. It did not make it easier for them to add new talent. They now have even fewer players that are that pass the an A test that they're willing to move, because they, you know, they have a lot of guys that are expensive, so they don't have that. They do have all these first round picks, but if they use those picks to draft a player, that guy's not going to be ready in a long time. This isn't a deep center draft. And if so, I guess their best option for that theoretically would be to combine some salary and players into something to make it work. And incidentally, that might be a good logic to keep Festus Ezeli's contract, because that might be the best thing they have to work with.
Yeah, in terms of matching salary. But I mean, keeping his contract, I mean, when are you going to trade Festus at that point? I mean, a lot of teams can't do, I mean, they'll agree to trades during the draft, but they can't actually do it until the next year. And by then,
that's true.
Festus will have already guaranteed. So I don't know realistic that is that. Necessarily.
Oh, man.
To do that, it was suggested that maybe Festus should have been in this deal to help Denver get to the salary floor, but I think they would just prefer to have the additional flexibility going into the trade deadline. I think they're going to try and do something else as well, and we'll see. Maybe if there's some other moves that they could make that'll make this Plumlee thing make a little more sense. But for Portland, I still really like the trade for them. I mean, matching a big offer on Plumlee probably wasn't going to be an option. I thought that he is overrated. They did well to get this asset. Now, too, they have three first round picks this year that they, and you know, they made the playoffs last year. I don't think that getting the eighth seed really matters that much to them. It shouldn't. And now they have three first round picks that they can use as ammo, either to pick up somebody else who's a little bit cheaper, just, you know, contributors who might still be decent by the time, and cheap by the time Dame Lillard and CJ McCollum are still in their prime a couple of years from now, or they can use those picks as sweeteners to dump some of the bad contracts that they have on their books. And I think Myers Leonard certainly would be someone who would be a prime candidate for that. I don't know if Evan Turner, and they still seem to like Turner as well, but Myers Leonard is certainly someone that I think they could move on from.
Neil Olshey has a tough job in front of him, but this certainly makes it more palatable, because there are different ways that they can unload contracts. Maybe you even do like a player and a player with a bad contract plus a pick for a player with a better contract. Like, that's the way you could maybe make this work.
Sure.
So we'll have to see, but it's easier for them now, and they still have to find a center. I mean, if it's not Nurkic, it's going to be somebody else. And as Kevin Pelton wrote in his write-up,
but Nurkic has a chance though.
Sure.
To be the center that they need. I would say there's there's less than a 50% chance, but they have now a year and a half to try him out.
I think there's a good shot that he ends up being a good backup center for them, which would be a little bit hilarious if that's how it turns out, considering the big part of the reason he was traded was because that wasn't good enough for him in Denver.
Yeah, for Nurkic to succeed in Portland, he's got quick feet. I think he can be an adequate pick and roll defender. He's got long arms. I think he can really help them on the glass on both ends. Not really a great pick and roll scorer. Can shoot a little bit of mid-range jumper. It's going to be tough now if teams trap CJ and Dame. Nurkic, not a guy who's going to make a play. And he's just, frankly, has played selfishly in Denver. He's always trying to get a post up. If the ball goes in there, he's going to throw something up, and he shoots like, you know, 43% from the field, which is pathetic for someone of his ability and role, what his role should be. So he's going to have to change his game a little bit. Whether he is willing to do that, he wasn't willing to do that in Denver, particularly once he became a backup. Whether he can do that in Portland, in their culture, more of a winning established culture, despite the similar records of these teams, maybe that can happen because he does have a lot of talent. And so I thought this was a good buy low for Portland, and they got the pick as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly different. It came out of left field for me, but I understand it from their perspective because they got overpaid for the asset they had.
All right, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll be back 15 and 16 style on the Eastern Conference. So before you move on, I want to talk to you about Zeal. It's on-demand massage. You can listen to this podcast whenever you want. Why not get a massage whenever you want? There's even still time after you listen to this to get your significant other a Zeal massage for Valentine's Day. Zeal is better than getting a traditional massage at a spa for a number of reasons. They include the tip up front, and everything is transparent. You get a full breakdown of how much the therapist gets paid and how much the tip was. All that is on your receipt. And massage therapists get paid up to 3 times more through Zeal than at a traditional brick and mortar spa. That means you get better treatment because they make more money. They get better masseuses. In fact, they only hire 50% of the people, the masseuses who apply to them. And you can feel better that the person who's giving you a great massage gets paid what they're worth. There's no reason to pay for a bricks and mortar spa, renting out all this space, doing all these eye masks. I don't need that stuff. I think a lot of my listeners probably don't. You just need a good massage that's going to make you feel better, and you can get it right in your home. Takes less time. It's generally less expensive than going to a spa. You can get it on demand, even in as little as an hour, if that's what you want. So go to Zeal, Zeel.com, and select from top local license and pre-screened massage therapists. You can choose your favorite technique. I like to get the sports massage. If you have a gender preference, you can put that down as well. And of course, the time and location as well. So to help you get started and let them know that you came from us, our listeners can get $25 off their first massage by going to Zeel.com, Zeel.com, or the Zeel iPhone or Android app. Use that familiar promo code CAPSPACE, because we talk about CAPSPACE all the time in the program. That's Zeel, Zeel.com. And then make sure to click add a promo code at checkout to use my code CAPSPACE, get that $25 off, and let them know that you came from us. All right, let's start with Detroit and Toronto. What are the fundamentals on the Toronto Raptors and Detroit Pistons before we talk about them in the context of this game that they played last night?
The Toronto Raptors are now 32-23, 5-10 since the last time we did an East. Oof. 15-60.
Wow.
Second in offense still, 17th in defense, plus 5.3 net rating. And according to 538, a 1% chance of the top seed, 2% chance of the title, which is interesting. Projected to be fourth in the East with 48 wins.
Yeah, and this recent run has really just destroyed them. I mean, you remember we were talking about them surpassing Cleveland. They were given a 50% chance of that. They're now 10-14 since New Year's, 10-13 since New Year's, 0.2 net rating. They have the 22nd ranked defense in that time, only the 12th ranked offense, still 108.9 offensive rating, which is incredible that that's only 12th. That's where we are in offense these days. But yeah, it has not been good for Toronto. And I mean, they're now fourth in the East. I mean, they're going to have to play Cleveland in the second round. That's something that they thought they might have home court advantage in the finals. I'll just leave this out there. I don't want to talk about this because we want to just talk more about how they're playing. But if they get the fourth seed and they get swept by Cleveland or gentlemen sweep by Cleveland in the second round, that changes a lot of these decisions with their free agents much more. And there's also, is there pressure now for them to do a trade? I mean, I felt like they've been a little bit too complacent. Paul Millsap is not going to be available anymore. Mike Budenholzer specifically said that to Chris Vivlamore today. Serge Ibaka is another guy maybe who could help them. We'll get to him. But I mean, the way they've been playing, and then Patrick Patterson, his health has been a question. He's been in and out of the lineup with with a sore knee, didn't play in this one just Detroit. They desperately, desperately miss what he's been able to bring as a stretch four, because they don't really have any other fours who can play on the roster. Sullinger has been unplayable. Big surprise there. So, yeah, I don't know. But to think about it, there's a lot riding in these next 2 months on the future of the franchise. I mean, if they can't even get out of the second round, are they going to, you know, give Kyle Lowry a 5-year max deal? Are they going to pay him enough? Because, you know, Philly is coming with a max offer for him, probably, and maybe some other teams as well. Now, are they going to pay enough to stick with that? Or could this be the end of this era of Raptors basketball? All those questions now are in play in a much different fashion than we would have thought only a month and a half ago.
Ownership's willingness to spend is going to be a huge story, not only this offseason, but at the trade deadline, because almost all of the players that they would get are going to be pending free agents. Now, you can get a pending free agent and let them go as a rental, but generally speaking, the way you value them as assets is very different if you think you're going to retain them or not. So Serge Ibaka, let's say he's the best big guy that's available really for the price that they can give. If you get Serge Ibaka and you do better, you'll probably be under pressure to retain him, and he's taken pay cuts before, so he's probably not going to want to do that right now. So then you're looking at a very expensive team. So ownership, and ideally they would have an open line of communication with Masai Ujiri and say, okay, this is what we're thinking, but it can also change based on results. So it's incredibly complicated.
All right, let's roll through some of my observations from this game. I know you watched it as well. My number one observation is they desperately missed Patterson, and then they basically played almost all of the game. I focused mostly on the second half. They only played Carroll at the four for about 2 minutes. The rest of the time, it was two centers together, where it was Bebe and Valanciunas. They started with Poeltl and Valanciunas. And you can't guard anyone with those lineups. And those guys aren't going to kill you in the post. You just put your center on JV, and Bebe is not going to post up and hurt you there. They didn't get much on the offensive glass because Drummond did an excellent job there. Tobias Harris did a better job of rebounding. And Tobias Harris absolutely destroyed them in this one. They had Bebe guarding Tobias Harris. And big surprise, Tobias Harris had 24 points, 9 of 13 from the field, and was plus 26 in 31 minutes. It was just a disaster. And then the spacing on offense, DeRozan with two centers in, Corey Joseph, there's lineups with Corey Joseph, DeRozan, and two centers in. Like, you can't score with that amount of spacing on the floor. Like, it's just, you can't do it in this day and age with the zone defense that you can play. Detroit's not some great defensive team, but Toronto struggled to score in the second half, in large part, I think, due to that lack of spacing. You know, Terrence Ross barely played it. Norman Powell, I don't know if he was injured, but he didn't really, I don't think he played at all in the second half. And just not matching up to go swing. I know Damari Carroll hasn't been that awesome this year, but he's better than just playing two centers together when the other team is going with a combo forward who can handle the ball like Harris. They just got killed by them.
Toronto had 6 offensive rebounds in this game, despite playing two centers for almost the whole thing. And Norman Powell played 7 minutes total.
Yeah, maybe he was really bad in the first half, but still, like, you can't, I mean, it's not like Detroit has, maybe they felt like if they were too small, Marcus Morris would really start hurting them, but they had DeRozan on Marcus Morris, so that's not going to be any better than Powell or even Terrence Ross. It was very difficult for them. And there's some specific plays even that we can talk about in the last 5 minutes as Toronto kind of blew this one. You mentioned the lack of offensive rebounds. A lot of the transition points that Detroit got were because they went for the offensive glass, didn't get it, and now neither of their bigs were back. Both those guys are centers. Their instinct is to attack the offensive glass.
And that also tied in with one of the other distinctions in this game is how much better Detroit played with Ish Smith in the game than with Reggie Jackson. And I think some of that was also just opportunity. They had more looks when Ish was in, but also they were moving the ball better. And Detroit at their best actually has a lot of guys that can move the ball. They just don't have a lot of guys that can create seams against a normal defense, but you can create those seams when the other team is playing two centers and DeMar DeRozan.
Yeah, Jackson was negative 25 in 17 minutes, and his minutes did match up exclusively with John Luer, who was also negative 25 in 17 minutes. So Jackson maybe didn't have the best chance to succeed. If he had matched up his minutes with Harris, maybe he could have looked a little bit better. Defensively, he definitely got taken advantage of, though, and was only 1 out of 5 in the stretch that he had at the start of the third. His one shot, I think, in the third was a 3-pointer that he came down and took off the pick and roll, off the dribble. without any passes on the possession. And then he got cooked a couple of times defensively by Damari Carroll, who they're, of course, hiding him on Carroll, so he didn't have to guard Lowry or DeRozan. And then they, like, Carroll was scoring on him, and Carroll has been, you know, really pretty miserable offensively this year. So that was an issue. Before we move on, what are the Pistons' splits here and stats and all that stuff?
The Pistons are 26-30, 7-6 since the last time we did this, 23rd in offense, 11th in defense, negative 1.4 net rating, 58% chance of making the playoffs, and projected to be tied for 7th in the East with a whopping 39 wins.
Yeah, this East playoffs now for these last couple of spots are shaping up to have a lot of teams in it. I mean, I think there's like probably like 6 or 7 teams now with between like a 70 and like 20% chance at making the playoffs, including Miami with this incredible run they've been on, which we'll talk about more. This was a big collapse still by Toronto. They're led by 15 with 9:15 remaining in the game. I thought that KCP was excellent in this one. He was only at 8 out of 22 from the field, but just his ability to create shots off the dribble, he played 41 minutes, was impressive. He's getting a little bit more of a facility for that. Stanley Johnson, 24 minutes, had 11 points, 3 of 5 on threes, his three-pointer. I mean, he hasn't been hitting it overall, but just the way it looked is much better than when he came out. He is now doing like a quick hop. He's sped up his release, which is important because he has a relatively low release in front of his head. So Stanley can't get to the rim still. And if he's going to do anything off the dribble, he's kind of got to pull up for a mid-ranger that he creates space for with his body. If he gets to the rim, he's not a good passer. He doesn't really have any kind of a knack for finishing, isn't athletic at all either. So those are always adventurous when he drives in. If he just hits that shot, he was good defensively in this one. Marcus Morris has done more facing the basket this year as well. And we talked about how Tobias Harris was just going one-on-one a lot of times. He was running a pick and roll. Bebe had to play on ball pick and roll defense. It was crazy. And I thought Casey could have minimized the damage a little bit by maybe putting Bebe on Stanley Johnson instead of Harris. But that's still, Johnson can still shoot threes. Like Bebe is just, he's not a four. He can't guard the position. And then Ish Smith, as you mentioned, played the last 19 minutes of the second half. And it's tough for Van Gundy because although he loves Ish Smith is not your long-term answer at point guard. And so even though you're playing better with him in there, it seems pretty clear that they have been throughout most of the year. It's just you can't realize your ceiling as a team with Ish Smith as your starter at the point.
We saw some of those limitations early in the season. I mean, they turned it around. They had an overall better stretch than I expected before Reggie Jackson came back. They've just had a very disappointing stretch after Reggie Jackson came back.
So the last 5 minutes of this game were very interesting. Toronto was up 5 with 1:23 remaining. KCP, they ran a play for him out of the timeout, advanced the ball. He airballed a 3, and Andre Drummond got a loose ball foul on Kyle Lowry, made 1 of 2 free throws, which is actually good for him. After Toronto failed to score, KCP then came down. This is one of the plays. I mean, Lowry, a quality defender, although I think he's really started to slip this year at times, especially lately. KCP had a nice couple of crossovers on him in transition, pulled up off the dribble from 15 feet. That was an impressive move for KCP. Reggie Jackson, they panned to him. He was at least appeared to be into it and clapping and supporting his teammates, which was nice. And then the big possession with Detroit down 2, Toronto, of course, runs the clock down. In the last 5 minutes of this game, of course, they were starting every possession with 8 on the shot clock. This time there was a reason to run the clock down because there's only 30 seconds left by the end of the possession. But they did a 2-1 pick and roll, had Lowry fake the screen and then slip it. KCP, probably the best guy in the league you would want guarding someone like that just due to his closing speed. He runs Lowry off the line, and Lowry tries to drive, looked like he might have something, until he became aware that Bebe was standing in the near side corner spacing the floor. So you're probably okay helping off of him in the corner. Valanciunas was under the basket. They didn't have a passing angle to him. I think Carroll was on the weak side. And he couldn't do anything. He had to sort of like back it out, shoot a tough fadeaway over his left shoulder. Bebe at least did run back from the corner as the shot went up, which was good. Valanciunas tried for the offensive rebound, didn't get it. He was behind Drummond. But the big problem was then with Bebe a little behind the play. I think it was Lowry. No, I'm sorry. It was Carroll had to pick up Harris, who had the ball in his hands after the outlet, and then Bebe just had no idea who to guard. He just stood in the lane and didn't guard anyone. That left Lowry on the strong side, basically having to guard two guys, Smith and KCP. Runs out to Smith. Smith drives past him, throws it to KCP in the corner. Wide open three. Great no timeout by Stan Van Gundy there. And that was the winning bucket. They, of course, went to the DeMar DeRozan ISO on Marcus Morris. And DeMar cannot score on bigger, stronger guys. Like, he can't blow by anyone because he's too slow. They try to get smaller guys on him, then he can really abuse those guys. But if he's not strong enough to really work to his spot, and he also, there's only 8 seconds left when he got the ball, if he's not strong enough to work to his spot, he's basically just stuck with doing his pump fake and trying to get the guy in the air. He thought that he got Morris in the air. He didn't, and had to throw up a terrible shot, and that was the game. He was very irate that he didn't get the call, but he didn't deserve it.
He didn't deserve it. And I would also mention that DeMar DeRozan is plenty used to having to figure out something with only 8 seconds left in the shot clock, because that's basically Toronto's offense about half the time. So yeah,
DeRozan did play well, though. I mean, he was out for almost 2 weeks, I think, with that sprained ankle. And he, although worth noting, he at one point was 9 out of 15 and then finished 10 out of 21. So as it came down to crunch time, he was not really able to be effective. But he did have 26 points on 24 shooting possessions, which was relatively efficient overall for the game.
Oh God, how happy, how would they feel if they get not only the 4 seed, but they have to face the Pacers or the Hawks in the first round? I mean, those are both teams that can give them trouble.
Yeah, that's true. They could very easily lose in the first round. As you mentioned, if it was the Pacers, that could make things difficult too. You know, we probably spent enough time on these teams for now. We'll save some of the other kind of macro things maybe for later.
Okay. I want to mention one small thing on Detroit, just not really from this game, though it did come in a little bit, because they shot 29 free throws in this game, was that they're still dead last in free throw attempt rate, which you would never expect on a team that has Andre Drummond, but they just don't have other guys who draw fouls.
Yeah, and even before they won this game, but one of the issues with Detroit, I don't want to get into it too much, we spent a lot of time on them already, but and they don't really do anything well. Since January 1st, they're in the 20s on both offense and defense. And if you just look at their team overall, even on the offensive glass, they're not that good, because nobody else ever gets an offensive rebound other than Drummond. And Drummond even is not the force that he was a couple of years ago on the offensive glass. Let's get to the recently victorious in Portland Atlanta Hawks.
The Hawks are 32-23 after their win tonight, 9-6 since the last time we did this, 25th in offense, 5th in defense, slight negative 0.2 net rating, 99% chance of making the playoffs. I love that split. Slightly negative net rating, 99% chance of making the playoffs. Projected to be 5th in the East with 45 wins.
And that's the biggest thing that, you know, maybe Mike Budenholzer as a coach isn't capable of realizing that. Maybe the fan base can't take it. Whatever it is, this is a 500 team. They've just gotten lucky in close games. That's all it is. They're the 25th in offense. I see no way with their present personnel that they can really hope to improve that much. You know, they've got not much in the way of creators. Millsap is on the downside. Even if they re-sign him, he's kind of more of a secondary guy at best. Has taken a step back this year on offense. Schroeder, maybe he gets a little bit better, but I don't see the ceiling for him. So who really is the impetus to do much off the dribble for them? And that's why I think it's so important for them to restock the cupboard, move into a new era of Hawks basketball, because this is a 500 team. And to, if you're gonna pay Millsap a ton to re-sign him at age 32, or and then also you didn't get anything for him in a trade, they've got some of these other free agent to be's who maybe if you aggregate them together you could get something decent. That was my thinking, of course, in trading Millsap in the mock off season. Of course, Bud said to Chris Vivilmore today that Paul Millsap will not be traded, and they only have probably one more game before the trade deadline, so this is who they're going to be. We thought maybe they might get snapped back to reality by having a rough stretch, but that hasn't happened. I mean, you think of some of the wins that they've had. I mean, this win against Portland, Paul Millsap had to hit a crazy shot. That Houston game where they came down from like 20 points down in the fourth quarter because Tim Hardaway had 31 points. You know, not really that sustainable for these guys. And, you know, they have Cleveland there. Maybe they feel like they can get into the second round. And that's the other problem, too. If they were in the opposite side of the bracket from Cleveland, and it seems very unlikely that they will escape that side of the bracket, then maybe they could get to the East Finals. You could kind of delude yourself into thinking you could beat Toronto or Boston or whatever. None of those teams are that sexy. But yeah, so I think they're kind of blowing it here by not blowing it up.
Sometimes I hate how much we agree, but we've agreed on this for a long time because their ceiling is low, and I also don't think that they're in the right place to give Paul Millsap a 5-year max. I'm a big fan of Paul Millsap, but the entire point of that deal is the first 2 years.
I don't think anybody is in the right place to give Paul Millsap a 5-year max unless you are a championship contender at the for the first year that he would sign that contract, and you can't get him any other way, and you have no way to replace him. That's the only way I would want to sign Paul Millsap to a 5-year max, or even frankly a 4-year max, if we're being honest. Like, you got to be right damn there in contention, because that's just going to be a horrible contract by the end of it.
And now that we're in the world where the salary cap is not rising nearly as quickly, almost any team that does that is going to become expensive in terms of the luxury tax and everything else. Because if you're not in that realm, you're not going to be good enough to pay him. So I would move him. Somebody's going to value him. He's certainly a very talented player, has unquestioned all-star for me this year, but just not the right fit for them. And to say we're going to go with the ship, either A, you give him a bad contract, or B, you lose him for nothing, and it's your second all-star that you've lost for nothing in 2 years.
And the thing is, my prediction, I don't know this to be sure, but I think we're going to end up with the same almost exact situation as we did with Horford. Somebody is going to offer Millsap the max. The Hawks are not going to beat that. That situation will probably actually be a better situation for winning, maybe even than the Hawks would be going forward. And then Paul Millsap is going to leave while we hear about how the Hawks offer was so competitive and they were so close, and you know what, maybe it is, maybe it wasn't, but they're going to lose the guy and they're not going to get anything in return for him. Last year, not trading Horford was a little bit more defensible. Maybe because, I mean, you know, if it was just one first round pick or something for him, then all right, you just hold on to him and see. And they were a much better team at that point than they are now, even though their record is kind of the same. The fundamentals are not the same. Anything else you want to say on them before I talk a little bit about my film review of DeAndre Bembry?
The only thing I also want to say is that they're also further away from the real big success from when they, you know, finished first in the East and everything like that. And they know it's a fundamentally different team now. So you can't delude yourself into thinking we're going to become that team. That's gone. It's dead and buried.
Yeah. No, I mean, they were kind of chasing that dragon, being only a year removed from that 60-win team last year, and their defense was awesome. You know, so it made sense, I think, more to not trade Horford than it does to not trade Millsap. And then some of these other guys too, Cephalosha being among them. So DeAndre Bembry has been playing a lot the last 7 games with Thabo out with this groin injury. He's been averaging around 20 minutes a game, shooting 46% from the field. He really came onto my radar screen on that game we did the Twitter NBA show on, that crazy comeback that the Hawks had against Houston. He guarded James Harden quite well, played like the last 12 minutes of the game, was on the floor during that comeback. So I wanted to look at him more closely. He's shooting 46% from the field on the season, but only 46% true shooting. He does not shoot threes at all. In fact, has not made a three-pointer yet on the season, only taken 11 of them. And he's also only 6 of 14 from the foul line. So he doesn't get to the foul line, and he hasn't made them. I don't make much of that 6 for 14. But he didn't come out of college with a reputation as a shooter, and he looks okay comfortable taking it. He shoots kind of a set shot. Not comfortable really at all shooting jumpers off the dribble from shorter. He's got a lot of wasted motion in his jump shot. The last 7 games when he's been averaging that 20 minutes, only taken 5 threes and is 0 for 3 on those, and only taken 1 foul shot. So he has not been a major part of the offense. I think his defense has been solid. He's kind of skinny, but has been effective there, did a good job on Harden down the end of that game. So I think certainly his ability to be an average defender, maybe even above average in the league, is something I feel confident in. He's got 15% usage so far on the season. Spot ups, again, has not been effective at all. One of the things that he was supposed to be able to do is handle the ball a little bit more. He's done that to some extent, where he'll just kind of be handling up top as some other guys run off a floppy action. Only had 10 possessions so far as a pick and roll ball handler. Where he really has impressed a lot is his facility for cutting and getting out in transition. He runs the floor hard, and he just has a lot of great back cuts, nice little cuts from the wing as someone else drives. He'll cut right down the lane, uses back screens well, catches guys about to switch on off-ball action, and will cut right to the basket for a layup. Some very nice looking plays. Now, he's not amazing at actually finishing those plays because he doesn't have a ton of explosion, especially off of 2 feet. He'll get blocked a lot. Like, there's one play where he did a great backdoor, got right to the rim, and then just got blocked from behind by Will Barton, who's not like some amazing shot blocker. Had a couple of times, he doesn't have a ton of juice off the bounce, not really that many many moves either. I mean, you think of him as kind of like the shooting guard version of Evan Turner in terms of like his athleticism and his the moves that he has, but his ability to create separation like doesn't really have that much. I mean, he had one nice drive for a dunk where he went past Jarrell Arthur on a switch, but generally I think he's probably gonna be a pretty switchable guy and not a ton of explosion. Every once in a while you'll see him really like pop up. Like, you remember he had like that huge dunk in summer league that you mentioned. He had like one nice dunk, another time where he really rose up and tried to dunk on like some huge center, I can't remember who it was, off of 2 feet and got fouled, which was a surprise to me. But generally he doesn't seem to have that much lift. It's very odd how every once in a while he'll seem to get some. But I think that's all I have to say about him. I'm not sure whether he's going to be a good enough offensive player to be a solid rotation guy, especially since he was an older rookie. But, you know, Hawks University, maybe he'll learn to shoot at some point. And I think if he can make threes, he could get to be a valuable player because he is heady. He does have good passing vision, just generally a smart guy on the floor.
I also want to mention, you mentioned he's an older rookie, that he's 22, turns 23 this summer. So he is a little bit older in that end, but not like irrevocably.
He's not a Plumlee.
No.
Come in the league at like at 23, 24.
Or Taj Gibson.
Yeah. Longtime Dunked On listeners know that SeatGeek has been on the show forever. In fact, they're our inaugural sponsor way back in July of 2015. Yet they continue advertising with us, and it's for a good reason. Lots of Dunked On listeners like to use their service, and they want to get the word out to more of you. The SeatGeek app is all about convenience in two ways. One is you don't have to go to a bunch of different sites now worried that if you go to five sites, there might be a cheaper ticket on the sixth site. With SeatGeek, you always get the best deal on every ticket because they price compare for you by searching multiple ticket sites. Prices can vary depending on where you shop, but SeatGeek will always find you the lowest available price. The second convenience aspect of SeatGeek is they help you select the right ticket to buy really easily. Every ticket on SeatGeek is given a grade based on value, so you'll see any underpriced seats. You can go into the section that you want to sit in, find the best priced seats. It's really like a minute-long process to buy tickets now. It used to take like 20 minutes to go through all this stuff. Every ticket you buy on SeatGeek is also backed by their 100% guarantee. You don't have to worry about any counterfeit tickets. Shop on SeatGeek with confidence. And of course, my listeners get a discount by using that familiar CapSpace code, which of course we talk about all the time in the program, a $20 rebate on your tickets after you've made your first ticket purchase. So you can download that free SeatGeek app, go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter that promo code CapSpace. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first purchase. So download that free SeatGeek app, enter promo code CapSpace today. All right, that's about all we got on them. Let's move on to Boston.
The Boston Celtics, one of the biggest success stories of this time period, 36-19, 11-4 since the last time we did this, 6th in offense, 19th in defense, plus 3.4 net rating on the season. They now have a 30% chance of getting the number one seed in the East, 6% title odds per 538, projected to be second in the East with 54 wins.
Yeah, that 30% top seed seems exceedingly high to me.
I would agree.
So, you know, early in the season, we talked about how if the Celtics ended up as the 3 seed, there could be this threat to Cleveland, as you mentioned. Do you feel if they're the 2 seed now, they may not even play the Raptors. It might be Washington. How would you be feeling about all that?
If they're at full strength, I think they have about the same shot that I expected at the beginning of the year. Their offense has been way better than I expected, but their defense has been substantially worse. Avery Bradley being out so long with Achilles soreness is certainly an issue, and having him back will help a lot. But also, broadly speaking, they're still a deeper team, and they will lose some of that advantage in the playoffs. So I think they'll be good. I think they'll be better than the Raptors in the playoffs, which I thought beforehand, but they're not world beaters in any way at that point.
Yeah, Isaiah Thomas plays, what, like 34 minutes a game. It'll be interesting to see whether he can handle, because he runs off ball so much. I mean, that's been really an underrated part of his season is they used to put like longer defenders on him. And in the pick and roll, that was a problem. You remember Iman Shumpert 2 years ago shut him down in the playoffs, for example. And now, though, he's so fast running off of screens that those longer defenders have trouble keeping up with him. And then he's able to create openings that way. And then he's getting nice screens from Horford. Horford is really helping to dime him up as well. And then the spacing that their bigs generally provide when Amir Johnson is out of the game, it really helps him a lot as well. And of course, like the fact that he's making like every three-pointer this year helps a lot too. You got to go over every single one of those screens now. He's been awesome. It's going to be really interesting. One thing that's of note here, and they've been winning just fine. I mean, they killed the Jazz on the road over the weekend, had another nice win in Dallas, who's been playing well tonight. I mean, maybe Avery Bradley just like isn't that important to what they're doing. Maybe he's like kind of overrated. Is it possible?
It's possible, but I still think he helps them a lot as a one-on-one defender in the playoffs when things slow down. And there aren't going to be as many hiding places for Isaiah against the best of the best, but having another good one-on-one defender, Marcus Smart has had some nice stretches as well, but having those two guys together to sick on a good score will help a lot, and they can't do that right now. So I there's certainly a logic to that he is not as important in the regular season, but I'm still a believer in what he does.
Would you consider trading Bradley for a bouncier center who can defensive rebound and protect the rim and hopefully can get up for some alley-oops on offense?
Sure.
If there, I don't know who that would be necessarily.
Especially because he's a year away from being properly paid and will be, you know, he's going to be a real trap contract. Him and Isaiah, both of those guys together, they're going to have low cap holds, assuming they're still on the Celtics at that point, low cap holds. So you sit there and go, oh, well, great. We can throw money at them. It's not a big deal. And then those contracts are going to be horrendous, like 3 and 4 years out.
Yeah. You know, we said the same thing about Kyle Lowry. Isaiah, I think, is very somewhat similar as a late bloomer to him. And Lowry, I mean, we thought that Lowry, when he was a free agent 3 years ago, was already going to be on the downside and then had the two best seasons of his career. And Isaiah, of course, keeps getting much better. I didn't see how that was going to be possible this year, and I certainly was incorrect about that. This Bradley thing is a little concerning, though, like that he's been out for like over a month now, basically, with this Achilles soreness. It feels very similar to Mike Conley from last year. And while Conley thankfully has been able to come back this season, you know, you don't want Avery Bradley sitting out for 4 months. I do agree with you. I think he's still a valuable player. A couple other notes here. Jaylen Brown has a hip injury. He's going to be out until after the All-Star break. Doesn't sound like it's serious, though. And then I was on the True Hoop pod, Brian Windhorst and some of the other guys were talking about whether Al Horford has really been worth his contract. Has he been a disappointment in Boston to you, or is he doing exactly kind of what anyone reasonable would have thought that he would have done?
It's a little bit of a disappointment just because Atlanta had such a great defense last year, but Paul Millsap was an integral part of that, and they do not have the same guys around everything as the, especially with injuries, you know, that's another part of this that they do. But his ability to stretch the floor has really opened things up for Isaiah, and you can get I still think you can get a guy that makes sense with Horford, and his contract isn't great, but it's not horrendous in that way. And Boston is so flexible, and they have a lot of other good contracts that, worst comes to worst, if you get a better center or you get a better opportunity, then I don't think he's impossible to move. He's certainly not great, but he's not as tough as his former, as his college teammate, to move in that sort of a context.
Well, I think he just, you have to understand what he is as a player. I mean, we mentioned that Atlanta is now 25th in offense. They missed Jeff Teague too, who's quietly having an underrated season, but I mean, I think he's been solid. He's 30 years old. He's probably declined a little bit in the athletic categories and defensively. I compared some of his game to how he's been in Atlanta the last couple of years. His efficiency numbers have continued to decline. He's basically at 54% true shooting, so that's a little less than league average now, I think. Same usage, right around 20%. So if you're expecting Al Horford to be a dominant scorer, or hey, we're gonna throw it into the post to you, you know, that's not what he is. He's taking 34% of his shots from threes now instead of 24%, and basically the biggest difference is he doesn't really take shots at the rim as much anymore. 30% of his shots at the rim last year, that's reduced by a third this year, only 20% at the rim now. Taking a few more actually kind of post up 3 to 9 foot range shots, and he's also on pace for two-thirds as many dunks last year, which you would expect with the shots at the rim going down. Big difference though that's helped is his assist percentage is up from 17% to 24%, and that's been huge in terms of unlocking Avery Bradley when he's been out there, and of course Isaiah Thomas this great year that he's having. And moreover, the idea was, oh, has he really taken them to another level? Well, number one, I don't know what else they're supposed to do with that money. I mean, he certainly was a better usage than anything else they could have done, and just keeping a ton of cap space for this offseason. I don't see them getting two max free agents this offseason, one of whom would be better than Horford. And number two, they're 28-14 when he actually plays. And they're going to be likely the number two seed in the East. So what, I mean, they were 48 wins last year. If they're going to be playing at a 55 win pace when he's out there, like, he has made a difference for them. He's not a 20 win player, but, you know, he could make a difference of a few wins, and Isaiah playing better helps too.
And you talked about how he's shooting more threes this year. His percentage hasn't gone down. He was at 34.4 last year. He's at 34.9 this year. His free throw attempts he's never really been that great at that. I think he's a little bit lower this year than some of the prior years, but he's a similar guy, and I think it works out well with some of their lineups. And Boston has the ability to add talent around him so that it's not this, that he doesn't have to be the centerpiece of everything that they do. And I think his game works better in that than a lot of other players who could be put in a similar circumstance.
The Brooklyn Nets.
Ugh,
it's not really fair to make that noise every single time we discuss them. Although, I guess, who did you make it for last time where you're like, oh, this, I don't have any interest in this team anymore?
Oklahoma City.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I kind of agree, especially after all this crap now with that Russ KD game and just the self-righteousness
did you see that Russ,
even more so, right? Like just the fact that he is like, see, has been like, I mean, at least was a little bit better about it when he was interviewed before, you know, but like all this like attempted trolling of KD just because he left, like, you know, players are supposed to like support each other and like be in support of free agency and not just like go crazy. I mean, the only other person I ever remember being this butthurt about someone leaving was Mo Williams.
I was thinking, weren't the Celtics guys pretty pissed off when Ray Allen went to the Heat?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, they were not happy about that. That's a good point.
But since we're not doing Oklahoma City right now, I just want to mention this, that I don't know the exact number because Royce Young and Fred Katz were going through it, but they missed like 23 or 25 shots in a row, field goal attempts in a row in their game against the Wizards tonight.
Yeah, they have the shooters for that.
That's wild though. Like that reaches the point where it's like a movie that gets so bad it's good, where it's just like you're just impressed.
I don't believe in those movies, as I said on the Twitter NBA
show. That's right.
I don't derive entertainment from such things. But all right,
back
to the Brooklyn Nets.
With the Brooklyn Nets. Yeah. Brooklyn Nets are 9-46, 1-14 since the last 15-60, 28th in offense, 27th in defense, -8.1 net rating, last in the East, last in the NBA, projected to have 15 wins. And where I wanted to start with this is that we reached a weird threshold this week, which is that the Nets now have fewer projected wins for the season at 15 than the second worst record in the NBA already has.
That's bad.
It's really bad when you don't have your pick.
Yeah. Well, they've been a little bit unlucky. They should have 13 wins as an expected one loss at this point. They are first in pace right now, which definitely has not been conducive to winning. Very similar approach to what the Sixers did in the Hinkie era when they didn't have the talent at all. Let's say that Jeremy Lin were healthy. And then remember, we thought they would actually have decent depth at point guard and could even play two point guards together when they signed Vasquez. Then he just hurt his foot again and had to be released. If Lin and Vasquez were healthy, knowing what we know about the rest of their talent, like how many games do you think they would be on pace to win?
I think they'd be right around in line with the Suns, maybe in the low 20s. I think Suns are at like 26 right now. And also, the Nets are dead last in turnover rate.
So you think Jeremy Lin and Grievous Vasquez would have made like an 11 win difference for this team? I don't think it would be quite that high.
I think it's something close to that. And
it is, because they do have awful back. I mean, they're playing guys who are, I mean, maybe Spencer Dinwiddie, the way he's played, you know, he has an 11 PER starting. He's been, you know, shooting okay on threes, but doesn't have a ton of volume, and he only has 14% usage. I mean, that's like, and 14% usage on this Nets team that has nobody else to create shots. So that's like, you know, Spencer Dinwiddie is probably a third point guard if you squint real hard. Isaiah Whitehead has a 6.8 PER, and those have been their two point guards without Vasquez and Lin. So,
and
yeah, maybe,
and as
maybe
I
that
said,
is
their
10
last, their last in turnover rate, that would be a lot better. Even just staying responsible with the ball, they would be, if they were still playing at a higher pace, I think it would help a lot. It wouldn't solve all of their problems, but we've seen with the Nets and other teams in the past that not having guys who can run an offense can absolutely devastate your team.
Yeah, I mean, I asked the question, and it was funny to think about this, because remember when they were 4-5, and I was like, wow, Kenny Atkinson, like, pretty impressive to get them to 4-5 so far. Well, they're now 5-40 since then.
Jesus.
But I mean, where do you think they've been just in relation to the talent that's been available to them? I think 9 wins maybe is low there, but 13, which is their point differential, seems like pretty close to what they have.
Yeah, I have no opposition to that. Brooke Lopez has come down to earth a little bit, but still having a very good year. And some of their young guys have, some of them, Caris LeVert has been better than I expected. Joe Harris has been better than I expected. Granted, that's also because I didn't expect anything from Joe Harris. But yeah, I'd say that's pretty much in line with it. They're just a generic bad team.
Well, and if you think about it too, if you wanted to compare it to last year, they had Joe Johnson, who granted was awful for part of last year, but they had him for 2/3 of the year. They had Thad Young for the whole year too. So they had
Rondé for the first half, right? Rondé was...
I think he got hurt in like December or something. That's actually one thing that's a little concerning for me on Rondé is maybe he was never that athletic to begin with, or maybe he's just not as athletic after he had that foot injury. He's only got 14 dunks on the year, and I can't think of a single time. You know, I will admit to watching fewer Nets games than perhaps some other teams, but I haven't seen him make one wow athletic play really the entire year.
I saw him have one nice shot block, and I remember that, and I was like, oh, that was a nice play, but it was one. I think it was like 2 weeks after he got back, or two weeks in or something like that.
A couple other stats here. Joe Harris has been a slight bright spot, shooting 37% on threes, but shoots pretty poorly at the rim and doesn't get there very often, as you might expect for someone with his physical tools. And he also does absolutely nothing else in the box score besides shoot threes. And, you know, they have been pretty terrible with him on the floor. He's not a good defensive player. I mean, he might be a guy who could be like a fifth wing somewhere and play, but not someone I think of necessarily has the potential to be a rotation player on a good team. Updating how LeVert is doing, only 16% usage, which is a bit of a surprise. I mean, I guess Kilpatrick has been kind of their big usage guy. But, you know, average true shooting, 12 PR for LeVert. And encouraging for me is that he's at 55% on twos. And, you know, he's taking a lot of threes as well. He's only hitting 33%. That's not bad. I mean, he definitely looks like their best prospect at this point to me.
Which is surprising considering how much you and I both liked Rondé, but at this point with what they've shown this season, sure.
Justin Hamilton was a nice story early on, the way he hit his three-pointers. He's now shooting 30% on three-pointers, and that's really all that he does. He can block a shot every once in a while, but not a quality defensive player. And Brooke Lopez, another nice story, the way he was hitting his threes early on. He is now down to 34% on three-pointers, which, I mean, he still is a threat out there. You got to guard him. Like, that's important. But it seemed a lot cooler when he was making 40% of those shots.
It was very exciting. And he's 28 at this point, turns 29 later this calendar year. Is that right?
Yeah. And the reports continue to be that they are asking for 2 first-round picks for him. I understand that maybe at some point next year, they feel like they might, that reduces down to 1, or maybe this offseason it reduces down to 1. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how good he is anymore. They just, you know, he has no talent around him. And I do think he's one of your few centers who can really demand a double team in the post, especially if he has more talent around him. I mean, you remember Luke Walton was like scared of going with Draymond at center early last season because of Lopez. So he can hurt teams in the post. Like, that is a useful skill. But on a really good team, you know, is he sort of like a better version of like Jonas Valanciunas, kind of like that, who can shoot. I mean, that's a good player, but nonetheless, you know, probably a 25-minute-a-game guy, doesn't close some games just due to his defensive limitations. Should we move on to the free-falling Charlotte Hornets?
Let's do it. They are 24-31, 4-11 since the last 15-60, 16th in offense, 7th in defense, slight positive, 0.4 net rating, only a 33% chance of making the playoffs, projected to be tied for 10th in the East with 36 wins.
Wow, I really thought that Miles Plumlee trade was going to save them.
They've made a couple just absolutely eye-popping moves at various moments, and then a lot of other things that have worked out well. So I don't know how to reconcile everything with them, but, you know, the whole Kaminsky decision, I still am not the biggest fan of trading the 22nd pick for Marco Bellinelli, and the Plumlee trade is even worse than that because there just was not the upside.
Yeah, I agree with that, and this is a team that probably could use, I mean, I guess they weren't going to have flexibility anyway, but yeah, it's not good. And still, plus 0.4 net rating with Cody Zeller on the floor, over a 7 net rating. They, of course, have fallen apart with him off the floor, perhaps in part too because the rest of their bench hasn't been any good either. I mean, Zeller matches up his minutes a lot with Kemba Walker, and they have no way of scoring without Walker on the floor either, especially with the disappointing year from Batum. But these guys are basically like the anti-Hawks. They actually have a better net rating than the Hawks do, and yet, you know, they're 7 games under .500 and the Hawks are 9 games over. So they did make a trade today, though. They picked up Chris Anderson out with a torn ACL, basically a money-saving move from the Cavs. Anderson has about, you know, $300,000 left in salary. The Cavs paid them $700,000 and they made $400,000. They immediately will waive Birdman and then re-sign Mike Toby, a backup center out of Virginia, to another 10-day contract.
And this gets into the idea of just how little leverage there is to take on salary in the league right now, because Cleveland was over a barrel in terms of the necessity of doing this, not only to clear a roster spot, but just to save Dan Gilbert a bunch of money. And Charlotte made money on the deal. They went, sure, we're cool with it. They were able to acquire him. It didn't cost them anything in terms of roster spots or letting anybody go. And so Cleveland was able to get out of a small, bad contract for absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that saves Cleveland about 2.5 in luxury tax. So definitely well worth forking over the $700,000. I wanted to look at Frank Kaminsky at center. We've seen more of that now, both with the Plumlee trade. Cody Zeller came back with from his contused quad and then aggravated that and has been out again the last couple of games, both of which I think they've lost. So they've been playing Plumlee more, but Kaminsky has been at center. He has played 270 minutes in that time, and they have scored pretty well, 1.09 points per possession per NBA WOWIE. But unfortunately, they are giving up 1.15. Not a surprise, because Kaminsky is really not even a good enough rebounder as a power forward. Doesn't protect the rim at all. Opponents are shooting 56% on twos when he plays center, shooting 64% at the rim. That would be pretty close to worst in the league. Also taking 34% of their shots right at the rim as well. And then Kaminsky, as the center, only has 16.5% defensive rebound rate, which is inadequate for a center. And overall, Kaminsky just, he hasn't even made shots, right? Like he had a nice game against the Warriors, mostly in garbage time, where he made some threes, but generally has not. Only 486 true shooting and 30% on three-pointers, and he only shoots 55% at the rim, which of course is really pathetic for a seven-footer, because he has basically no explosion at all.
I don't know if it's just me, but it seems like a lot of these offense-only bigs are really struggling around the league, and also the prevalence now of getting a few more two-way guys at the top end of drafts, you know, the Miles Turners of the world, who actually they passed on and could have taken instead.
Oh, yeah.
And those guys are making it even harder to survive. That and the fact that, as we talked about with the Raptors-Pistons game, teams can just go small if they have enough wings. So some players like Kaminsky will get marginalized into smaller roles, and some will probably get played out of rotations.
Another quick note here. Jeremy Lamb has been in and out of the lineup with injuries, and just Steve Clifford doesn't like him, but he's shooting a mere 25% on threes so far this season. And he had mysteriously a great defensive rating, great net rating last year. That has not proven to be the case so far this year. And their bench last year was so good. And of course, that's been a major disappointment for them so far this year. Let's move on to the 26 and 29 Chicago Bulls.
Another rosy, shiny situation. 5-8 since the last time we did this. 20th in offense, 14th in defense, -1.3 net rating. 538 gives them a 58% chance of making the playoffs, tied for 7th in the East with 39 wins.
Yeah, another team really that's in the same morass. And we saw them in person, a gutted version of the team. Dwayne Wade was sick. Jimmy Butler out with a heel injury. Butler attempted to return in Phoenix the following night. Saturday, did not play well. They got blown out by Phoenix. Then Butler, I guess that was not Saturday night, that was like Thursday night, but anyway, Butler then was not able to play in Thibba Bowl 2, in which the Bulls had another embarrassing loss. Wade now has a sprained wrist, so he may be out for their next game and through the All-Star break. Butler, him trying to come back and then having to sit out again, that's never good. And of course, he admitted that, hey, I'm still having some pain in my heel, but I'm going to try to play anyway. Yeah, Jimmy Butler, like, feeling pain and trying to play doesn't work too well. You remember that he almost had what looked like a severe knee injury and wasn't the same last year after he missed a game due to knee tendonitis, came back and then hurt it in Denver and missed a month last season. They would have made the playoffs if that hadn't happened. And of course, without him, they are miserable because when he's on, plus 2.7 net rating, when he's off, -9.7 and a 99.2 offensive rating when he is off the floor. It's 106.6 when he's on the floor.
But it's a good thing they missed the playoffs last year because that improved their pick enough so that they could get Denzel Valentine.
Yeah, he played a fair amount in that game that we saw in person in Golden State. Didn't really do much of anything. Couldn't hit a shot. I mean, I think he'll come around as far as being able to shoot. He was a good shooter in college, but not really clear what else he does. Just completely incapable of getting to the rim. Not a great defender. Didn't have great awareness trying to guard Klay Thompson in that game. Just lost him on a couple of occasions, really for no reason at all. Doesn't have great physical tools. We'll get some steals every once in a while, but still just not really clear exactly like what kind of good NBA player he's supposed to be. Certainly as a starter, I just don't see how he really has that upside at this point. He's a decent passer, certainly, but just not dynamic enough to where you're going to want to put the ball in his hands. And then if you're not doing that, then he's just kind of a spot up shooter. So I never really saw the point of him to begin with. And he's kind of, well, he's struggled with some sprained ankles so far. It's still an issue. Doug McDermott also has had a massive struggle, even with Jimmy Butler out. He's been passed in the rotation by Paul Zipser, who has played well and impressed me before he injured his ankle against the Warriors. I mean, are we ready to give up on Doug McDermott being like, you know, a really solid player in the league, or is there still hope for him?
I don't have much hope that he can be a starter, but I still believe that he can be a solid rotation player, third forward, fourth forward type thing, because he can score if you put him in the right circumstance, and I still believe he can stand still, catch and shoot.
Yeah, remember how I was like all excited that he'd like gotten a few post-ups and been really efficient on it last time?
I do.
Well... Yeah, I sort of reached the point where I was like, I guess that's a rhetorical question. I should probably just answer it myself before Danny just has to say yes, and then I just continue on. So he's gotten a whole 7 more post-ups in the 13 games since we last talked about it. Still has been efficient on those. I mean, they've been desperate for offense. Just like throw it to the guy. Let us see what he can do. What about Mirotić? Are we ready to give up on him as potentially a starter in this league? Now he'll be 26 in the offseason.
Getting real close, because the shooting hasn't been there. And something that you noted is that he's not getting to the line. And that combination, plus he was a solid defensive rebounder early on, that's enough to be a starter, even with everything else. But as soon as one or two of those legs drop out, it gets really hard.
I would like to still see him play with Taj Gibson in that front court. That's always been pretty effective all 3 years. But yeah, I mean, Mirotić looked like a guy who could be like a very, and we were talking about him after his first year of being like a more dynamic, slightly better defending Ryan Anderson who gets to the foul line, you know, as a guy who could pass, do some stuff off the dribble, post up pretty well against switches. He's 7 out of 21 on post-ups so far this year. And of course, his shooting from three after a nice year last year has been 30% again. His usage is down, which is crazy to think about considering how much more offensive talent that team his rookie year had. But yeah, as you mentioned, the free throw rate is huge. And a lot of his free throw rate was artificially propped up by all of his like, and now he would really hustle a lot for rebounds and get in position to get to start flopping for loose ball fouls, which he doesn't really do as much anymore. But he had a 46% free throw rate his first year, and it's 21% now. I mean, that is just, that's why he has a 500 true shooting percentage now. He just has no way really to be efficient unless he's hitting threes. And, you know, he doesn't drive to the basket anymore, really. And they just need him to stand out at the arc and space the floor. What about Bobby Portis? We can ask the same question here. I mean, as we go through every prospect on the Bulls roster and ask if it's time to give up on them yet.
Hard to do when he just set a career high with 16 points against the Timberwolves. But I don't think he's going to be a starter. Maybe he becomes a curiosity as a 10 to 15 minute a game forward, powerful forward, but I don't expect more than that at this point.
He's another player where, and with some of the moves that the Chicago front office has made, they just
And I like Zipser, actually. I think he fits into the modern game much more as a combo forward who can shoot the ball, at least, and, you know, hopefully his shots continue to go in. But Bobby Portis, the theory of him, even when he was drafted, just didn't quite make sense because he's not athletic enough to protect the rim at all. I think they probably felt that he plays hard and he could be better defensively. You know, and remember, that was a pick that was universally lauded at the time it was made. And early last year, everyone was like, he's so good. And I was like, all right, calm down a little bit. Like, his defense is horrible. And it always has been. And he can shoot the ball, but can't really do much else. Not really much of a post game. He's got a nice jump hook, but that's, you know, maybe against switches every once in a while type of thing. He's not going to go get you buckets in the post. And so it's just like, all right, he's just a pure four. Yeah, he can shoot a little bit, but he's so bad defensively at either power position and he can't switch at all. There's just no real theory, even if he does make his jump shot, which I think he can get to if he hasn't already. There's just no real theory of like how he becomes more than, like you were saying, a back of the rotation type of player, just due to what his skill set is, even if he maximizes that skill set.
Do we want to kill their guards now or save that for the next one of these?
Yeah, let's move on. One more thing, though. This team should be trading anything that's not nailed down. Taj Gibson, if you can get a first rounder for him, please sign up. If you don't think that Mirotić is part of the future and he's been kind of not playing that much, then he missed some time. If there's anyone who will give you anything for him, I mean, it's hard to imagine they could get a first rounder for him. So maybe you just hold on to his restricted rights and hope that he turns it around. But yeah, I mean, you talk about the lack of coherence in the front office and the type of players that they're getting, you know, Valentine, another one, and don't even get started on how they have absolutely nobody who can shoot on this team. But then the coaching staff as well, just yanking guys' roles around all the time in ways that just don't particularly seem to make sense, right? It's just kind of like, well, this isn't working, let's try something else. But the something else, there's no theory behind it of like why it's going to work in terms of some of the rotational changes that they make.
It's a classic example for me of a situation, I've brought this up before, of if you don't trust the people to make the next set of moves, you shouldn't trust their front office to make this set of moves. And of course, Garpax is going to be around not only this year, but probably next year and moving forward.
Yeah, that was a report by Casey Johnson that they will be around through the summer. All right, I think that'll do it for this first edition of the 15 and 60. Stay tuned tomorrow. We'll go through some news and then get to the rest of the teams as well, including the streaking Miami Heat, the Wizards, and so on. Don't forget about our sponsors today, Zeal. That cat space code can get you $25 off your first massage. It's a great company that helps the people who actually give you the massage, who deserve the money, helps them get paid more than maybe a bricks and mortar spa would. And it's more convenient. You don't have to go anywhere. They just come right to your house. And then, of course, SeatGeek, you can get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase by using that cap space code as well. And don't forget, too, tomorrow night, probably today as you're listening to this, Tuesday night, Cavs and Wolves. It'll be on NBA TV, but it is nationally televised. Only 3 games, so hopefully a lot of people will be watching that. Going to do the Twitter NBA show second screen, so follow me on Periscope. Look out for my tweets about that. Hopefully you can join me. A lot of people had some nice things to say about the first one, and it was really a lot of fun to do, to just give some live commentary during the game. Talk to you all tomorrow night. Till then.